Hello, everyone, to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. And our friend with us today is Andrew Dewhurst. Spout out your Twitter moniker, please.
Sure. I can be found at Andrew K. Dewhurst.
Well, that is exactly what I asked, wasn't it? We are getting towards the end of my drafting season. I have one draft left. Are you completely done drafting, Andrew?
I am. I finished my last draft this morning. I think I did six in the last 6 weeks.
Well, the amazing thing for me is our head-to-head categories staff league is still not done drafting. I had the slowest TGFBI league and the head-to-head draft going on at one time. I am done drafting in the head-to-head league. I'm just waiting for the people, the schmucks at the end, to fill in the last little boxes in the big old diagram that they send us now, which is just fine. I have what I think is a very important concept for us to talk about today. And that's some of the trite that you hear about how you draft and how you should draft. And me trying to debunk some of the drafting theory. I know a lot of people will have drafts left here in the last week and a half or so. And people will also be able to reflect back on the drafts that they have. We do something when we prepare for drafts that people call a tiering system, which I think almost everybody out there is familiar with. You have certain people that you like that you would consider to be SP1 worthy versus, you know, being more like a starting pitcher too. And you see a natural fall off within those tiers, and that's what has you create that line of demarcation. Well, while we do these tiers in our head, and it's certainly a very important thing for me, I want to know how deep the positions are. I want to have a feel for both the quality and the quantity of players that I find suitable to be on my team at each position. Well, while we do that, there's this old cliche that everyone uses that while you draft, you should not play into a run. If a bunch of starting pitchers go in front of you, and that's a great time for you to pick up a player because a player, a hitter's value, obviously all those pitchers taken in front of them mean that the hitter's value is greater there than taking a starting pitcher. But if you're to do that, then a lot of times you're going against your tiers and you're saying to yourself, well, okay, this tier is almost empty, but I'm not going to take one of those guys because a bunch of the starting pitchers have been taken in front of them. And those two things to me create a complete contrast that can't really happen, meaning that in my opinion, you cannot have a tiering system in your head and not play into runs. Another way of putting this perhaps, and I'm trying to make it clearer for Andrew because him and I went back and forth on this even before the show started. Another way is you hear people say, well, I just let the draft fall to me. Which is okay, but if you're true to your tiering systems and you're just taking whoever you think the best player is, then all of a sudden aren't you missing out on some of the tiers of good players and starting your team with people in your second and third, sometimes fourth tier at a position instead of trying to get as many positions covered as possible in your upper tiers. So what do you think of the concept now? Is it a little more clear to you, Andrew?
Yeah, it's much more clear to me. And I think I agree. It's definitely worth a conversation because I think a lot of the stuff hangs people up and is something that can lead people to end up finishing their draft and not liking their teams. Right. Because there's definitely some space where you become really rigid or you didn't create your tiers and you looked at some place like, you know, maybe the Friends with Fantasy Benefits draft guide, and you looked at Mr. Ben Brennis's tiers, and you just followed those entirely and said, like, I want to make sure I get somebody from this tier and somebody from this tier and somebody from this tier, as opposed to understanding your the comfort level and why the players are valued differently in different places.
You know, it's certainly possible that the best draft approach is sort of a mix of the two, because there is a difference. I sort of take my tiers and I build a plan, a game plan around it, on which of the lower tiers in our 15-team NFBC style leagues that we've done a lot of, or in our 18-team or 19-team staff league, you're not going to get a top-tier player at every position. It's physically impossible. And so I think perhaps the best way to do it is a mix of these players. Deciding, well, the lower tier first baseman and the lower tier shortstop, you may have even heard me say this already, and I apologize if you have, were the places that I thought I could take gambles, and I liked the upside of the players. And so I was willing to miss the entire first tier of first baseman going into the drafting season. It did become problematic as the drafting season went on because, you know, I ending up with the Logan Morrisons of the world and trying to bank on Justin Smoke or Carlos Santana being especially good in his new environment. Things like that are what happened for me making that decision. And I get that. But I just think it's entirely impossible to go off of completely off tiers or go completely against whatever you think the run is that's happening. And I specifically chose out players for us to look at today that I thought were in interesting spots in tiers. And I wanted to discuss with Andrew both what he thinks of these players for this year. And I was openly wondering if he would be able to diagnose sort of what tier bottom I would be referring to by the players that I picked out. The first player that I picked out is Yu Darvish, now of the Chicago Cubs. I ended up with Yu Darvish in two or three leagues. I took him at the end of a long pitching run, which was the first reason that I chose him. I took him at the end of a long pitching run, and the pitcher who was taken after him was Chris Archer, who was taken the very next pick, which made 10 out of 12 picks starting pitchers in the third round of a 15-team NFBC league. And I thought that Yu Darvish was the last player in that tier by a significant amount. So obviously, I mean, he didn't have his best portfolio-style season last year, and it ended in a bit of controversy with him pitching so poorly in the playoffs. But I wonder what you think about Yu Darvish, and I wonder if you think he is the last ace or the last ace potential pitcher out there.
I don't know if he's the last ace or ace potential pitcher out there, because I think there's a lot of, I think he's the last, he's probably the last, the last pitcher in your second tier. That would be my guess. I like Yu Darvish. I think a lot of people are left with a bit of a bad taste in their mouth because of the playoffs. But all things being said, I mean, I'll ask you a couple questions and you can answer them for me. And I think it'll help make it easier to understand whether you think you sure shouldn't be in on Yu Darvish this year. Did he start more than 30 times last year?
He sure did.
Did he pitch more than 180 innings last year?
He did.
Was his K per nine over 10 last year?
It was, which is, that's significant.
Yeah, it is. And you think about moving from the Rangers, where he spent most of his time last year, to spending the whole year with the Cubs. And I can see 15 wins without too much trouble in his future this year. If he gives you over 180 innings again, what's not to like about Yu Darvish? Most of his problems, especially in the World Series, were that his slider just wasn't working. It was just sitting there and spinning. And I've heard lots of people that are much more intelligent than me on pitchers talk about that and just note it as being really bizarre. And they couldn't explain it. So I think in this case, I think he's worth the place he's getting taken. And he's probably at the end of the year might be a pitcher that's potentially top, what, five-ish worthy if things break the right way. And that at the worst would be, what, a top 15? Like, could you imagine him being worse than a top 15 starting pitcher this year?
I doubt he could be worse than a top 15 pitcher if, as long as he stays healthy.
Right.
And, you know, he did have some, he had his health woes and, you know, missed 2015 and 2016 was, you know, a recovery sort of year. The peripherals, when you look at Darvish's season last year, he had gave up the highest home run to fly ball rate that he's had, 15.1%. And he struggled a little bit. The .283 BABIP was on the higher side of any of the BABIPs that he's allowed. And the 1.3 home runs per nine, which I guess would go along with the home run fly ball rate. But, you know, FIP and XFIP still actually liked him to be closer to a 3.5 ERA pitcher than a 3.86 pitcher. And when you draft a Cub, I always feel like you're a little bit at the whim of the weather gods. Just because if he were to catch the bad luck of having four or five home starts where the wind was just bailing out, you know, it's going to make things a little bit trickier, and it could actually cost you like 0.25 points of ERA by the end of the season. But that being said, I still think the difference between pitching in Texas and pitching in both the National League and for the Cubs is significant. And the Cubs are a very defensive-oriented team to me. I really like their defense. Javi Baez's defense has been ballyhooed a great deal, but Addison Russell is an excellent shortstop, and Chris Bryant's an excellent third baseman. And they have to play Jason Hayward, which, you know, helps an outfield defense that looks pretty good already.
Okay.
And maybe Schwarber's better this year defensively. I mean, that's certainly losing the 25 pounds can't hurt anything. So I think there is value here, and I do think he's the last pitcher that I was okay calling my ace or anchoring my staff. Interestingly enough, I'm curious, are you would you prefer Yu Darvish or would you prefer Carlos Martinez?
At this exact moment in time, I'd prefer Yu Darvish. If you asked me this question 4 months ago, I would have said Carlos Martinez. I'm a little worried about Carlos Martinez's off the field issues at the moment. Just because it creates uncertainty, and I don't want to be taking a pitcher that I thought I was banking on 200 innings, 200 strikeouts on, to find out that his head's somewhere else because he's getting rightly or wrongly dragged through the mud because of some issues that happened off the field.
See, sometimes, you know, we have sort of a Cardinal insider on our staff, and sometimes I just wonder, and I know we didn't even have Carlos Martinez on our list. I haven't seen an official report about anything that has happened. I've sort of heard, you know, that he had left camp for a personal issue for various stretches of time. And that's what I've heard, which I find odd in this day and age. Like, I would expect it to be more nationalized. I'm not sure that's really a word, but I used it anyway. Nationalized, and I haven't seen an official report. So I'm kind of curious as to where he is. Carlos Martinez is a guy that we've had some high hopes for, and we've seen just this very slight incremental growth into a potential ace out of Carlos Martinez. So I thought that was an interesting tier point. And I wanted to get into the tier discussion partially because, like I said, at the end of a run, I could have taken Rhys Hoskins, who was a player I liked a ton, but then I was not going to have a starting pitcher that I thought was ace quality for sure because Carlos Martinez was long gone at that point. So the next person that I wanted to point out is Greg Bird. And I did a combination of people I thought fell in certain tiers and a combination of people that I didn't think we had spent a whole lot of time on. So why don't you tell me what your theory is on Greg Bird and his going to perhaps the most beastly lineup, getting inserted in the most beastly lineup we can remember?
I'm not in it. I just can't. I continue to not be able to sell myself on Greg Bird. And there's a few reasons in it. I mean, one, how much opportunity is actually there? So just validating where his expected hitting slot is. But I mean, if you're hitting behind Judge and Stanton, which is kind of where I would expect him to be, sometimes you're going to be like, how many RBI opportunities are really going to be there? Like, there might not be anything left. Right now, Roster Resource has him slotted hitting seventh behind, which to me says, okay, so that's after what? Gregorius, Hicks, Stanton. So, well, Sanchez, Gregorius, Hicks, Sanchez, Gregorius, and then Hicks, then Bird. I don't have a ton of confidence there. He's always struggled with his health. The makeup of the lineup, which isn't necessarily one that leads him to be in a great spot, considering he's hitting seventh, which leaves, you know, Mia Walker, Brandon Drury to drive him in before they move back to the top of the lineup. So Greg Bird's just a guy that I'm not taking. I know the park's great. I know the lineup's great. But at his draft cost, I mean, I don't feel any more secure in drafting him versus the health of Lucas Duda, even if it's in a worse ballpark. Like, I think you very well could end up in the exact same place, getting the same guy, you know, almost 10 rounds later.
Well, I think this is going to be a case where we have a player in, like, completely different tier, which is why you go through the why you go through the process. I do concede that I really struggle with being overly reliant on a guy who has never played 50 games in a major league season. It's hard to fathom. He also has a major league high in a season of 11 home runs, which granted is tied into the fact that, you know, he got called up fairly late in 2015, and he's had health struggles basically ever since then. But the eternal optimist would say, you know, you're looking at a guy who consistently has a walk rate up over 10%, which is a nice little line that we like to put out there that matters. And he's coming off a season where, you know, he only had a 194 BABIP. You know, he's getting to the point where almost every year he's 100 points higher in his OBP than he is in his batting average. And it could be said that he's in the perfect park. And as far as rolling the dice and saying if he had an entire season, healthy season, if you could get one out of him, that he's going in areas and drafts that you're not used to being able to have 35 home run potential. He's also a guy that's just been loved by, he's been loved by the pundits within the industry for being the right kind of swing in the right kind of stadium. And we've seen a lot of that with Yankee Stadium in recent years. I actually had him on this list thinking that he was the last player that you could consider to be your first baseman versus like your corner infielder. But I'm assuming that the Duda comparison means that Lucas Duda, who I had a local draft yesterday, and Lucas Duda did not even get taken in a 12-team draft. So I'm of the opinion that you are far less optimistic. Like, I think you would panic if you ended up with Greg Bird as your first name. Is that true?
It is. I just wouldn't pick. I just move on. Like, if I'm at pick 140, like, I'm just pulling up the ADP from TGFBI. For anyone, if they're not aware, they're 15-team leagues. There's 13 of them. So I feel like there's some, like, it's pretty good ADP. It was min 122, max 188. 147.8 was his ADP. I'm just going to move on. I'm going to say, like, at this point, like, okay. And I did this on the weekend. I had a draft on Friday night. And I ended up with, like, the name escapes me, but the Martinez, who's going to be playing first base for the Cardinals. That's who I ended up with at first base, because I was just like, I looked at it and said, like, I would rather move on and get a better player that I can have more certainty in than draft a guy like Greg Bird. Because when I look at Bird statistically, there's not actually enough sample size in any of his years to take anything away from, like, cause it's always sub 50. Like, is he like with, and I'm not a scout, so I don't make raw skill designations to say, like, this kind of swing can net me, he can be a 270 hitter, or he can hit 50 home runs. So it's just looking at it and saying, like, well, like, all of this information could more or less be completely thrown away because the sample is so small. Right, like, it's easy to look at it like, well, he hit 9 home runs in 47 games last year. So if we extrapolate that, you know, we're looking at, 27 home runs and multiplying things out that way. But we also know that doing that extrapolation exercise is false. And that's because, you know, baseball is a game of averages. Things at the end of the year, more or less, typically we find play out to those averages if there is not a significant skill change or like approach change. So we just don't have that kind of information. That's kind of leaves me out on players like Greg Bird. And I it's one of those spots where I'm happy to let someone else take the risk. I will, you know, continuously drift down on that spot while I try to improve my team in other spots.
Well, I will both, I can see that at the times that he's going, there's still other good players at other positions on the board. But I'll also mention, you know, a guy like Jose Martinez that you're speaking of, he comes with his own form of risk as well, which I just say is, you know, everybody would love for Jose Martinez to play full bore, but his playing time seems sort of akin to what happens with Matt Carpenter and his shoulder, and if Matt Carpenter can move around the diamond and play some third base. Just to keep both sides of the news coverage out there, there is now, they use like 5 or 6 different projection systems on FanGraphs. And of those projection systems, there's only one projection system that has him for less than 26 home runs this year. And once you get to that area of the first baseman, and some leagues you're going to see him fall, you're going to have people who have the Andrew Dewhurst opinion, which is completely justified. But if you're sort of swinging for the fences, to use a double entendre kind of pun there for us, if you're swinging for the fences and you want somebody with a ton of upside, I do think that Greg Bird falls towards the bottom of a tier of those players. Let's play a game. I mean, because I think you're going to go against Greg Bird on all of these, which I'm going to be able to see it, and I'm going to be able to understand in my head how someone would prefer Bird. Would you? Is Greg Bird or Ryan Zimmerman for you?
Ryan Zimmerman. Lineup's the same. Like, I don't think you can say one is significantly better or worse than the other as far as the lineup goes. And at least you can say Zimmerman has played a full year in his past.
How about Greg Bird or Logan Morrison?
Logan Morrison. And both have sketchy health. But at the price that you're paying for Morrison versus the price you're paying for Bird, I'm more willing to take the risk.
See, I'm
qualifying that one, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I don't feel comfortable. Like, I guess if this somehow isn't clear by now, I'm just not comfortable with Bird's health. And the problem with the projection systems is that two of the projection, like all but two of the six projection systems on Fangraphs have him playing more games than he's played in the last 2 years.
You know, and it's so we debate back and forth, you know, skill is, or health is a skill until it's not there. Everything that can possibly happen with health, we can go on and on about, you know, my first year owning Madison Bumgarner last year is exhibit A of why I'm dubious about both health histories and trying to project health futures, which is certainly the case. But I would also mention that to me, Greg Bird is a guy that if his draft price falls at all, that if you're in a contest that has an overall, maybe, and you really feel like going for it, I feel like he's somebody that maybe has a little more value in that format. Like those, you know, like an NFBC overall format, where you're trying to win your individual league, but the real prize is in something more than that. Yeah. So Greg Bird is going to be a very fascinating player this year because I understand what Andrew Dewars is saying about Greg Bird batting seventh in the order and how that could limit him somewhat. That is not a normal order. And you're going to see a lot of base runners to me in front of the number seven hitter there, just because I think people are going to shy away from wanting to pitch to a lot of the middle of that lineup. So perhaps he ends up in more RBI producing situations than you might think of any other number seven hitter.
Yeah, I guess the best way I can think of Greg Bird is he's a lottery ticket. And if you're willing to grab lottery tickets at the 150 range, then, you know, you're welcome to that. You'll just need to make sure that you've got something else to back it up.
Yeah, and there's, like you mentioned, I've seen Logan Morrison fall a ridiculous amount in certain drafts, and I've been on the Lomo train, as the FWFB staff chat would be evidence of. So anyway, let's move on to our next guy. And our next guy is obviously near and dear to me because he was the anchor of the Milwaukee Brewers bullpen last year, and that's Corey Knebel. And I chose him. Why? What tier do you think I have Corey Knebel in? This is pretty obvious, isn't it?
Well, in your heart, I feel like he's in the top tier. But I'm guessing in your mind, he might be in the second tier.
Well, I hope you're wrong. I mean, oddly enough, Corey Knebel is not the kind of player I would regularly own because I have a tendency to go mid-tier or lower when it comes to trying to collect saves. But he's a guy who is, to me, I think is going at the back end, at the very far end of the first tier of closers. And for people who really enjoy chasing, you know, gaudy peripherals, I think the 14.92 Ks per nine last year is pretty gaudy. And, you know, the 1.78 ERA, even though FIP and XFIP were a little more sour on him, they had him in the mid twos, heaven forbid. I think, speaks to the fact that if you want a top tier closer, you could easily be caught thinking to yourself, well, if I don't get Knebel, I see Roberto Ozuna go after him, which seems like a bit of a drop off. So I'm just curious how you are on Knebel this year.
I like Knebel. I'm like, when I look at my relievers, I typically, if I'm drafting them high, like I want those strikeouts there because that's to me the biggest differentiator between getting a mid tier closer and a top tier closer is, you know, when you put the saves aside, you know, where are they actually contributing? And saves is, or strikeouts is the other category that you're getting contribution from. And as you noted, you know, Knebel provided those in spades last year as he struck out 126 batters, which is crazy in 76 innings. I mean, there's a few things to note, right? Like his left on base percentage at 91.9%. Might be a titch high, So there'll be a slight amount of regression there, probably 6 to 10%, I would assume. Both players you noted, like, I like Roberto Osuna. Roberto Osuna had a really good year last year while being really unlucky. So I think there's actually room for him to grow. But that also being said, I don't think he's going to have, like, Osuna's not going to have the save opportunities that I expect Knebel will have this year. So,
well, from, if you'll allow me to use the fact that I watch nearly every Brewers game, the biggest thing about Knebel is that when Knebel has his breaking pitch, when Knebel has his curveball, I mean, it's forget it. I mean, it's literally forget it. If he's throwing his breaking pitch for strikes, the batters have as close to no chance as you will see major league hitters have. When he can't throw his breaking pitches for strikes, he turns into a guy who's like a 60-40 kind of guy. You know he's going to be in trouble. Almost all of his base runners are given up when he cannot throw his curveball for a strike. When he can throw his curveball for a strike, you just get such a tremendous gap between the pitching. And what it does is it opens up the window for hitters to have to swing at his high fastball, which is just it's inconceivable that that's going to go very well for very many players at the major league level. So, it's one thing. That's one thing to watch. He also had a reputation. He's been around. He was a top draft pick years ago, way back, before 2013. And he struggled some with his health. And there was a fear, and I remember stating this fear, that Knebel was not a guy that could really be used on back-to-back days, which I thought limited the chances that he had, that he was going to be made into the closer eventually. And so, and you can look at his innings totals, and basically at the major league level, he upped his inning total, by a solid 26 innings over his next highest year. And so there has been a tinge of durability concern with Knebel. And, people wondered how well he would bounce back. And so now this year we have to wonder if he can do it in back-to-back years. As much of a Brewers fan as I am, I'm a little concerned about their roster construction and a little concerned about their starters. So I'm not as bullish on save opportunities as everyone else is. I would consider the same amount of wins the Brewers had last year to be an expectable outcome with what they have not done with their starting rotation. So I thought Corey Knebel was an interesting guy to talk about. I have the traditional theory that I care very little about the peripherals of my closers. I want my closers to be as secure in their job as possible. Which Knebel couldn't have any more security. I want him to be as secure as possible and be on teams that I think, are going to win their fair share of games. And while Knebel certainly checks those two things off the list, I do struggle with if people are reaching for him early in like the, third to early fourth round, because the frequency and how soon closers go off the board definitely changes a lot from league to league. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, it's definitely been all over the board. And sometimes I've been part of that frequency. I think I've taken guys like Kenley Jansen as high as like the late third round. I think like the reason why I care so much about getting the strikeouts out of my closers is because we know that jobs are often not certain. So at the very worst, like I don't want my pick, like if you're taking Mark Melancon this year and he loses the job and he pitches like the seventh or eighth inning, you're getting nothing from him. That pick is garbage. You're throwing him away and moving forward. But like if Knebel lost the job and moved into a setup role, at the very least, you could hold him on your roster. He would continue to strike out lots of guys while you waited and hope that he regained the job because whomever they brought in front of him had lost it. So that's just the reasoning why I see, like, why I think the strikeout portion of that is ultimately really nice to have. And I also just want to take a quick minute to play a little bit of revisionist history, because I thought this trade was really ironic in that in 2014, the Tigers traded Knebel and Jake Thompson for Joachim Soria. I think if you can go back and look at that one, probably you don't want Soria and you want to have Corey Knebel if you're going to look at it today. But I always find trades like that interesting when you trade a guy who turns out to be significantly better than the guy you traded for within a fairly short period of time.
Well, it's funny that you said the revisionist history, because I had my skepticism about Knebel ever getting to this level of being a closer. And part of my skepticism was that the Brewers were his third organization in a 2-year period. That's fairly unusual for a guy with this kind of elite talent and elite upside, for him to be moved around like that at the minor league level. That's more than fairly unusual. It's downright odd. So he definitely had his struggles and had seasons where, you know, he was barely pitching over 30 innings when he was a lot younger. So it's a meteoric rise within what I've seen of his career, and that scares me to some extent, yet his dominance was so clear last year. And when I say the peripherals, I agree with you about the strikeouts. I think people get caught up on trying to draft whip and ERA. And when you're talking about a guy who's going to pitch in 35 games, two or three bad outings where he actually gets kept in the game instead of taken out of the game suddenly can skew the whip and the ERA a lot. And I have struggle with the concept that someone who might pitch 45 or 50 innings is going to make that dramatic of an effect on your end game, even in this day and age where starters aren't pitching as much, in your end game ERA and your end game whip. So what do you think of that?
Yes and no, right? Like 50, as an individual, I agree. Like 50 innings of an elite ERA and elite whip over the, like when you take that across your, what, 1,000 pitch minimum, or, you know, upwards of 1,500 innings, like the effect of 50 is almost null. But if you look at your relievers collectively, and, you know, if you're looking at, you know, say 200 innings of elite whip and ERA, now you're going to see it a little bit more of a dent, as essentially, you know, you start to be able to say, like, well, if I can get two relievers that give me, you know, if my three relievers give me that, essentially it's one elite starting pitcher, or one and a half, something along that line.
Yeah, I guess I do see that. And, of course, we're hinting at the evolving role of the relief pitcher in fantasy baseball. I purposely am taking the league that I run, my home league, and I'm purposely making relievers as important as possible because, obviously, while they're hard to predict which relievers are going to – the next Chad Green is hard to predict, I think the steady Andrew Millers and the steady – you know, David Robertson, these kind of players have immense value within the game. And I do think that our game should reflect that.
Yeah.
And so I'm very much pro that, but I'm not completely on board with holds. So it's kind of a difficult line to walk, but I'm trying to walk it regardless. Oh, the next guy that I pointed us towards, I thought when we speak about tiers, we often forget that you can draft within tiers and still be missing categories. Jonathan Scope is considered an upper level second baseman, but he doesn't run like a second baseman normally. And the guy that I pointed to is the last guy I believed that had elite strikeout upside while still having some significant pitching upside. And that's Denilson Lamet, who is the 25-year-old Padres pitcher who has some really odd stat qualities. I wouldn't say, maybe it's not that unusual for a pitcher to be wild and be dominant. But he definitely lived life on the edge last year, and he had got just destroyed in a couple starts, which is something that we really don't like in fantasy. The concept of a guy giving up 9 or 10 runs in a, you know, less than a couple innings is something we obviously avoid. But where Danielson Lamet is going in drafts, it's just hard to fathom that you can find anybody else who's got the potential to have an 11.5 K per nine. You know, it was close to 11 last year already. So what do you think about Danielson Lamet? And do you see him as the bottom pitcher if you feel like you've fallen behind in strikeouts?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's kind of your line of demarcation in some sorts of, like, you know, where things start to drop off and get a little bit scary around pick 200. Nearly an 11 K per nine last year. And I guess it's important though to remember that guys who strike people out do kind of live on that fringe a little bit. It's hard to strike a lot of people out when you're living in the zone. And he did have an 11.8% swing strike rate. So a lot of that was effective. So I think there's some, like, I can understand, like, there's a reason why he's going at the place he is with that kind of strikeout profile for a starter. And I think it's largely because there's no real history here. So people are a little bit bullish to push him up too much. I mean, he did still have a 1.42 home run per nine last year. He walked a fair amount of guys with a 4.25 walk per nine. So, I think if you need those strikeouts and you can believe in Lamet, then you're welcome to do so. Go and get that. But you're taking on some risk at the same time. You probably can't count on him for 10 wins. And you have to be willing to say that, you know, this is going to be a guy that you might drop in the first 2 months of the year if things start to go really bad.
Yeah, I see all of the I see all of these scenarios as more than plausible with Danielson Lamet. I would say one thing, you know, I classify some things on categories wise as if you didn't have as many strikeouts as you wanted, it's quite likely that you have a larger amount of reliability in front of them than normal. The Zach Greinke-esque, you know, you don't know what you're getting for strikeouts, but you know that if he's healthy, he's going to be really solid. The Jose Quintana, the guys who don't overwhelm you with strikeouts, the reason that they would be that you would be drafting them in your upper tiers would be because of their reliability factor. So that cuts in somewhat to the whip issues that a guy like Danielson Lamet is inherent in if it goes wrong. And now we, of course, have the Robbie Ray model that we didn't have before, this meteoric jump from a guy with really good strikeout numbers but pretty scary and sketchy peripherals to finding enough control and enough of an edge to turn himself into a top 15 pitcher pretty easily. I thought Danielson Lamet was kind of an interesting guy, and I did want to hear exactly where Andrew was on him. He's a guy that I end up not having is by and large. How many shares of Danielson Lamet do you have, sir?
Sorry, yeah, I don't have any shares of Danielson Lamet. But I mean, that's for actually the opposite of the reasons that you talked about. Like, I'm getting, like, I've started drafts with starters. Like with guys like Scherzer and Sale and Kluber and Kershaw to make sure that I'm getting those strikeouts. And like, that's something that I covet in my starters. So by the time I'm getting that late into my pitching, that's the place where I'm looking to get stability and trying to get guys like Jay Happ and players of that, like, who I know will, should provide me some stability deeper down the road.
Yeah, the 14.8% home run to fly ball rate last year seemed like pretty bad fortune for Lamet as well. I mean, I know some of this stuff just goes along with being a young pitcher who has, you know, fits of command and control issues. That's for sure. And so it's just a matter of trying to decide how much you want to gamble and exactly, you know, how likely you feel it is that this curve is going to point upward for him, because just a tick more of control could really be a dramatic return on investment on where we have to draft one to Nelson Lamet.
Yeah. The only other thing, the last thing I think I'd note on Lamet is I think you have to be weary of how many innings he could realistically pitch this year. I mean, last year was as high at 114.1. And there's usually a kind of rule of thumb of that, like, they teams don't like to move young starters forward by more than like 30 innings or something. So I think if you're going to be drafting a guy like Lamet and you're getting his 140-ish innings, I think you need to also be considering, like, at that moment in time, who you might be looking to pick up, whether it be someone that's a free agent or maybe trying to wait and grab somebody like a Michael Kopech when they get called up to kind of fill in that role the rest of the way.
Yeah, he's going to be a fascinating case study this year because he's one of those guys who's – you get a peripheral like that, and this isn't sort of the make-or-break season. I think the next two or three seasons you're going to see people willing to take that kind of gamble towards the end of the draft. He's like a rich man's Nick Pivetta or, you know, and that's one thing. I mean, that's one of the things here is that, like I said, you're not going to find, you know, give me some names of pitchers going after him that have his kind of, you know, upside with his ability to strike out batters. It's pretty bereft of pitchers that are in that, that have that skill set. Do you agree?
Let me put this in perspective, actually, because this is fascinating now that I look at it. So these are the next starters that went after Denelson Lamet in the TGFBI ADP. Mike Clevinger, before anyone was guaranteed that he would have a starting job. Dylan Bundy, Kenta Maeda, Danny Salazar, Kevin Gausman, Michael Wacha. In your opinion, are you taking Lamet over any of those guys or even more than 50%?
I would struggle. This is part of why I don't own Nelson Lamet. because if I felt remotely comfortable with my strikeout pitchers, before that, I would scuffle to take him to Nelson Lamet over most of those pitchers. I could take Lamet over Kevin Gausman. I am not a Gausman believer. That one I can see. But you know, I like Wacha a whole lot, and it was curious because I'm assuming you went in order.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah, I like Wacha a whole lot more than I like Lamet. So there was sort of a scattering amongst how much more I liked those pitchers than Lamet. But I think I would have Lamet like second to last on that list, you know, which I see. But at the same time, you can make the argument, you know, Michael Wacha's best case scenario, it has him as what, like a top 20-ish pitcher? I don't see a whole lot more chances than that. Whereas Denelson Lamet, I think, could easily squeeze his way into the top 15 if the control comes around a great deal. So yeah, I wouldn't be taking him there. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think of like, I mean, when you think about the strikeout upside, though, like I feel like you would rather have Danny Salazar.
Well. Danny Salazar really stuck out when you said it to me too, because I've been a believer for a long time that both Salazar and Carrasco were not going to be healthy very much. And Carrasco has proven me wrong. So I'm holding on to the Salazar injury island pretty hard and heavy. And he is hurt right now,
yeah.
Which doesn't help. Now, the world knows that I'm all in on Clevinger. You know, I saw a number of his starts last year. And I like how his approach was to spring training and how they've embraced him. I'm all in on Clevinger. So I would have Clevinger as the top pitcher that you mentioned, and not by a little. So, you know, there's something to be said for Dinelson Lamet if you get him at a bargain, because I do think there within that glob of pitchers, I'm sure there's a number of drafts where Lamet is going towards the bottom of that group, or maybe even completely at the end of that group as well. So, no, but like I said, I wanted to talk about it as a category, you know, like what we're going to do with a category. And, it, you know, do you make out your tiers merely by position, or do you think of some tiers category-wise?
I don't make out tiers at all, to be honest with you. Like, I just kind of, in my head, what I'm doing is I'm just keeping in mind, I mean, I naturally go towards strikeout pitchers. So when I'm going through it, I literally am more of the person, more than I even realized this year, especially that I was somebody who's letting the draft come to them. Because you get into the first few players, you're getting your guys. And earlier in draft season, I was definitely like, yep, you know, especially in some of the, you know, you go get your guys, you got to go get your guys. But as it actually played out, I didn't actually do that. I used to try to use tiers, you know, years back, and it just never worked out for me. I found I was reaching for players to be like, oh, that's the last guy in this tier, I better make sure I go and get him. Instead of just getting a better value, because there was, you know, the overall value of maybe the fourth starting pitching tier was actually much greater than, say, like the second starting, like the second base tier.
Yeah, I think I enjoy the tiering process as far as me trying to evaluate from position to position. But, you know, at the same time, within starting pitching this year, I considered the aces and the second tier and the glob of pitching.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's part of the reason why, you know, Dinelson Lamet to me is a guy that is in the glob, and you have to decide, you know, how much you need those. I want to look at it one other way here as well, as long as we're talking about categories. You know, Andrew Dewhurst is a speed guy for sure. Every time he's commented on my teams, he sort of looks at, you know, do you have enough speed? And one of the things that I find interesting category wise is when you talk about late end game speed guys, you know, people will downgrade Delino DeShields, who's a hot name in the speed market right now because of his announced role in Texas. You know, they'll talk about their batting average risk, you know, power potential, you know, do they have any power potential, or are they just a speed guy? Well, to me, if you're drafting a guy for speed, right, you should have average and power already, right? I mean, you know, what were you drafting? You know, if by the time you're deciding if you want, Leonis Martin or Cameron Maybit, okay, by the time you make that decision in your head, you're trying to make that decision, right? The issues that you're thinking to yourself, I mean, not that you don't want upside in the other categories, I'm not saying that, but really you should just think, well, which guy do I think is going to run the most? Because you should have covered the other things if you're at the point where you need Cameron Maybin or Leonis Martin, right? Does that not make sense to you?
It does. I mean, this is the way that I put it, and this is how I wrote it. I wrote an article about this in the draft guide. It's how many players do you need to get to a Billy Hamilton? Right? It's like you would need possibly, what, three or four 20 steal guys. But the average number of stolen bases per player among qualified players was only like 9. So you need, like, sorry, we'll just do the quick math on this. If you're just going to grab average stolen base guys, right? If Billy Hamilton steals 60, I need like almost seven of those guys to get one Billy Hamilton. But average number of home runs hit last year per player was like 23. So I only need three of those guys, and I'm past whatever I've gotten from Giancarlo Stanton. So if I can get three of those guys that hit 25 to 30 home runs, who also chip in 10 steals each, then I'm in a much better position to make good use of somebody that might also, like, to grab a late game, you know, steals guy, and, you know, a guy like Ketel Marte, a guy like Jerron Dyson, and, you know, and you're already in a pretty good spot while not having to take the risk of Billy Hamilton because his kind of poor average and he might not contribute anything in home runs and RBIs, while also not taking on the negative average of having to get a guy like Giancarlo Stanton to fill up your home run space. So that's the way that this happens in my head, is that it's like I could get three really good players who will provide me both, or I could put it all on one side and then like really hurt myself as I try to fill my roster in later in the game.
Yeah, I thought it was curious because I think strikeouts and stolen bases seem to be the categories that you hear most about in, you know, that portion of your drafting. So I just wanted to compare and contrast the two a bit for us. There's one more player that I want to cover, and it's just because within this conversation of trying to figure out if you should draft out of necessity, or if you should draft the best player, which is kind of how I frame this whole thing. Starlin Castro is a guy who is, literally bottomed out on draft boards by, you know, moving to the Miami Marlins and then announcing his displeasure of being there, which almost every Marlin has at this point. But he's also a guy who, you know, has had significant value fantasy-wise in a number of different seasons. He's been, you know, in the bigs since 2010, despite the fact that he's only 27 years old. He was a player who, you know, was thought of last year as a really nice fallback sleeper option in middle infield. And now I see him going as sort of the last viable middle infielder, like the last guy that you could put in your MI slot and say, well, you know, I got this guy and he's guaranteed playing time and he's got a, you know, still got a Scotia upside. So what is your take on Starlin Castro this year?
I think Starlin Castro might be the unluckiest player, at least in recent memory. Like, he dealt with the Cubs through their awful years. They finally start to get good and he gets shipped to the Yankees. He's with the Yankees. They get good. He gets shipped to the Marlins. just seems like an unlucky guy. I compared Starlin Castro actually quite a bit to a guy like Robinson Cano. Their profiles seem very similar. Doesn't walk a lot. Doesn't strike out too much. I mean, I know he struck out 19.7% last year, but he does offer you, you know, he's a guy at second base that'll offer you about 20 home runs. It's going to give you, you know, an okay amount, like about 70 runs and RBIs. So, and hit for a decent average. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think of him as very much a Robinson Cano light at Cano's current stage of his career.
Well, I think that's a fair assessment. Part of this was, I was just wondering, would you be comfortable if you thought you were strong everywhere else? Like, he's one of those guys that you don't really think about, per se, at the draft table, and then somebody takes him, but the person who takes him seems to be fairly confident.
Yeah, you know? I mean,
and I don't know if it's name value at this point or what it is, but would you be comfortable with Starlin Castro as your middle infielder if he was the last guy that you were putting in your roster?
I don't, comfortable is such a fascinating word sometimes. I don't know how comfortable I would be. I would be comfortable with him as a reserve, because I think if I told you that Starlin Castro played for the Nationals, you would draft him about 200 slots higher than he's going.
That's a nice estimate. It's not even wrong. That's why it's such a nice estimate.
But when you think about that, right, like, he wants out. The Marlins have no good reason to keep him around because he's not selling you tickets. No one's showing up to the ballpark saying, God, I can't wait to see Starlin Castro play today. So there's reason to think that he will get moved out at some point in time. And if he's at a guy that you drafted that, you know, in the 400 range, you know, that could be a really nice value, you know, when, if should he eventually end up in a really good environment.
Yeah, it's an oddity. And like I said, I haven't heard a lot of shows covering Starlin Castro, which was part of the reason that I picked him. And I also picked him because I thought he was a different part of our overall concept today. So I remember, you know, there's this thing that my wife and I joke about all the time about how announcers like to say that certain players play the game the right way, right? Well, Starlin Castro, I remember him. We pay a lot of extra attention to the Cubs here just because, you know, they're in their division with us. And as a Cub, he had these fits of wandering around at shortstop where, like, the team didn't really know that he was completely out there, like forgetting how many outs there are, things that are the opposite of what you think of a shortstop. But at the same time, he was 20 years old. And at 20 years old, you're talking about a guy who, you know, he had 20 stolen back-to-back 20 stolen base seasons, and people saw him as, you know, he hit over 300 at a very young age. So there was a ton of talent, but he wasn't always focused. And obviously, I think the thing that's detracting me from him now is that stigma stays with me, that he struggles to stay focused. You know, like, I think Hanley Ramirez is especially focused this year, but we all know he's struggled to stay focused. Well, if you're struggling to stay focused and you're on a team that is going to struggle to put 25,000 fans in the seats on opening day, it just seems to me like this is a situation that's ripe for him to completely mentally wander and perhaps just fall off a cliff. But they're also unpredictable. This kind of mental approach is very unpredictable. He may decide that if he focuses and plays well, that's his ticket out.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's hard. Yeah, I just see it as like, I see like one of two outcomes. If Don Mattingly can find some way to motivate him so that he knows what's happening at any moment in time during a game, then, you know, you've probably done all right with Starlin Castro. But I also can see him kind of, to your point, as that guy. And I don't know if you've ever heard these Ricky Henderson stories where, like, Ricky Henderson gets, like, later in his career is playing with John Olerud, and I think in, like, for the Mets. And John Olerud's trying to explain to Ricky Henderson that they played together, like, 10 years ago. And Ricky's like, no, I don't know who you are.
There's good John Olerud stories like that, though. You know, John Olerud used to take the subway into the games when he was – because nobody recognized him. Like, he could just take the subway into the game, which is a bizarre thought at this point. But I do see all these scenarios as possible with Starlin Castro, and I just – it just amazes me. He's the guy who he's the guy who does two things for me now. He's a guy I never own that I'm just curious to see how his path is going to go because of how we talk about age all the time. You know, he's a 20-year-old player, and you think to yourself, oh, he's got 12 to 15 years of big league production in front of him. And now he's 27, and you think, well,
he's got 12 months of big league production in front of him.
So he's that guy. And the other thing that I really find annoying about him is that when he's Starlin – and Marte is Starling, it really makes it hard for me to remember if I'm supposed to say the G or not.
Yeah. So, I think there definitely needs to be banners up around like the Marlin Stadium that just says Starlin the Marlin.
There you go. Hey, thank you, Starlin the Marlin. Maybe I'll be able to remember it that way. Thank you. Anyway, my friend, I really appreciate you going along with me. This is the first time I really had to try and get the concept through to us per se before the show started. So you did an excellent job of rolling with it as usual. Andrew, why don't you tell people where you can be reached on Twitter and what you're working on right now, and we'll get out of here.
Sure. Find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. Not necessarily working on anything in particular at the moment. Be coming up with biweekly baseball stuff. Still doing weekly hockey stuff. So staying busy, obviously doing this show every Monday with you. But yeah, it's kind of where I'm at right now. And, you know, we're down to 10 days till opening day. So finally we can start seeing all that hard work in our draft prep start to hopefully pay off.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm lamenting, you know, last year my season started so poorly in fantasy. I don't know if I'm lamenting opening day or just looking forward to it. I know I'm looking forward to the baseball part of it. Even if stuff starts to unravel early again, I still love the game that much. I'm Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It. Andrew and I obviously did work for the Fantasy Benefit, which is can still be purchased on Amazon. It's a really nice tool. It's like having a roster resource with you at the draft in a print form, which I know a lot of people like. You can get it as either an e-file, or you can get it as sent as a PDF, or you can order the paperback off of Amazon, and we would appreciate that a great deal. Rate and review us on iTunes or your various podcatchers. We would appreciate that as well. Thanks, everyone, for the listen. This was the Concept Podcast, where we discussed if the two things could jive, both drafting by peers and avoiding playing into runs. So thank you so much for the listen, and we will go from there.